Russia suspends its participation in a key nuclear arms treaty with the U.S., saying no one must be under any illusion that global strategic parity can be destroyed. China pledges to promote dialogue to resolve the Ukraine conflict, urging certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire of the war. And the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the U.N. Security Council for a watered-down statement that replaced a resolution condemning Israel's settlement plans. World News coming to you live out of our studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. First Story takes us to Russia this hour, where President Vladimir Putin suspends the participation of his country in the New START treaty with the United States. Well, the treaty controls the two sides' strategic nuclear arms.
They want to deliver us a strategical defeat while crawling into our strategic nuclear objects. Regarding this, I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty, but suspends its participation. Before resuming the discussion of this treaty, we must first understand what do countries of the North Atlantic Alliance, such as France and Great Britain, aspire, and how will we take their strategic arsenals into account.
Putin made the remarks in an annual State of the Nation address. He said given the current conflict in Ukraine, Russia allowing the U.S. to inspect its facilities is, quote, a theater of the absurd. He also accused the U.S.-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kiev with arms and munitions. The president warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. Putin noted that Kiev is a launching pad for Western governments' war against Russia, with little regard for Ukrainians.
The responsibility for fueling the Ukrainian conflict, for its escalation, for the number of victims, lies completely with Western elites, and of course with the current Kiev regime, for whom the Ukrainian people are essentially strangers. The current Ukrainian regime is not serving its national interests, but those of third countries.
Putin also slammed the Western sanctions on Russia as an economic war. He said they sought to make Russians suffer, but they failed as sanctions are punishing their own countries and economies. He said the Russian economy has grown despite the restrictions and pledged to replace the U.S. dollar and other Western currencies in trade transactions with other countries. And now to China, which warns that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries, without naming any, to stop adding fuel to the fire.
We urge the countries concerned to stop adding fuel to the fire as soon as possible, to stop shifting the blame to China, and to stop making an uproar by shouting, today Ukraine, tomorrow Taiwan. The pressure and attempts to contain China coming from the outside are getting stronger and stronger. They are getting worse and worse, posing a serious threat to China's sovereignty and security.
The Chinese foreign minister was addressing a security conference in Beijing. He said his country is deeply concerned about the situation and trying to find a political solution to the conflict. His comments came after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of mulling sending arms to Russia. NATO has also echoed the U.S. concerns, saying China may supply Russia with weapons. Beijing has rejected the claim as false and said it is the U.S. that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. Meanwhile, China's senior diplomat Wang Ying has arrived in Moscow for talks that are expected to focus on Ukraine. Earlier, we talked to independent China specialist Andrew Leung to know his take on the U.S. claims about China's military support for Russia.
But there is no doubt that China has been pushed by the United States into closer relationship with Russia, because both China and Russia are being targeted by the United States as their arch enemies. And of course, China and Russia, their two economies are extremely complementary. And Russia, is one of the world's largest exporters of energy and agricultural products, whereas China is the world's largest customer. So the two sides are much closer together. And this rhetoric about China supplying arms to Russia is a bit over the tops, because and in the Munich Security Conference, Wang Yi, the state counselor, and the top person in charge of foreign policy in China, already said openly that China is going to table a peace plan, perhaps after talking to Putin. So I think that China wants peace. China doesn't want to get involved in worsening the conflict. China doesn't want to supply arms. And in fact, the largest supplier of arms making the conflict worse is not China, but the United States and NATO.
Well, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen says the island is expanding its military cooperation with the United States as she takes a swipe at what she calls China's expansionism.
Taiwan and the United States continue to bolster military exchanges, and going forward, Taiwan will cooperate even more actively with the U.S. and other democratic partners to confront global challenges such as authoritarian expansionism and climate change.
President Tsai made the comment during a meeting with a visiting delegation of U.S. lawmakers. The head of the delegation said the trip is aimed at bolstering security and economic ties with Taiwan. This comes a week after a senior U.S. State Department official traveled to the island. The visit by U.S. officials to Taipei has increased over the past months, despite repeated warnings from China against growing diplomatic and military nexus between the U.S. and Taiwan. China considers the island as part of its territory and believes the U.S. support emboldens pro-independence forces in Taiwan. Well, Iran has vowed to impose retaliatory sanctions against the EU after the bloc slapped fresh bans on Tehran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the countermeasures will be announced soon. The EU imposed asset freezes and visa bans on 32 individuals and two entities, including Iran's education and culture ministers. The UK has also blacklisted 8 individuals. Most of those targeted are lawmakers, judiciary officials, and prison authorities. Western powers have imposed several rounds of such sanctions on Iran in recent months, accusing the country of cracking down on protesters. Tehran has repeatedly dismissed those accusations, saying it has been lawfully dealing with rioters disrupting public security. Iran says the West is using human rights as a tool in its pressure campaign against the country. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the UN Security Council for its weak position on Israel's expansionist plans in the occupied territories. That after the Security Council failed to pass a resolution, which, if approved, would demand the regime put an end to its settlement activities. And we've discussed this issue in our news review program. Let's take a look.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the UN Security Council for taking an understated stance on Israel's plan to expand settlements in the occupied territories. The Hamas condemnation comes after the UNSC fell short of passing a resolution which would have demanded the regime put an end to its settlement activities. Hamas is issuing a statement instead of passing a resolution, shows the world body has evaded its responsibilities to ensure that international regulations and conventions are not violated. On Monday, the 15-member body issued a statement expressing deep concern and dismay over Israel's announcement of settlement expansion. It said the regime's scheme would jeopardize the viability of a so-called two-state solution. The statement, however, does not have the binding force of a resolution draft submitted earlier to the UNSC. Israel has recently authorized 9 settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, Israel is pressing ahead with its arbitrary detention of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Regime forces have arrested nearly 24 people in their fresh raids across the West Bank. 15 Palestinians were detained after the regime's troops raided refugee camps south of the city of Hebron. Others were taken into custody after the military made incursions into other areas in the West Bank. Israel's deadly crackdown against Palestinians and their unjustified detentions continue unabated. Hundreds of Palestinians have been languishing in Israeli jail years without charge or trial. In protest at the regime's illegal detention and inhumane treatment, Palestinian inmates have been staging a hunger strike for the 8th day in a row. Yonah Rabai is a human rights activist joining us from Beirut, and we have Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, joining us from occupied Ramallah. Well, I'd like to welcome you both. And Yonah Rabai, let me first start with you, and let's focus on this, what was supposed to be a resolution at the UN, which was not to be. It came out to be just a statement, basically in opposing what is known to be a violation of international law, and that is the building of settlements. Why is it that the UN did not opt for a UN resolution, which would be obviously more binding than just an opposition?
Well, hello to you first, and greetings to all your viewers. These facts today raise the role of the United Nations in the issue of the Palestinian cause as a whole and the humanitarian files. The United Nations has never been actually concerned with protecting the rights of the Palestinian people or any vulnerable people in general, despite the legislation, covenants, the international agreements concerned with human rights and regulation and regulating rules of military conflicts, the implementation of which is not mandatory and violating them is not considered a reason for tangible accountability, unlike the consequences of violating economic and security agreements. Firstly, because the member states of the Security Council give priority to political, economic, and security interests over human rights interests. And secondly, because the colonial states have the final say in the Security Council. And here I'm not talking about the veto rights, but about the influence of the colonial states, especially the United States of America, on the decision of other countries which sold their sovereignty in foreign decisions to the USA. Today, as always, Israel finds itself internationally protected, or at least not held accountable for its crimes. The settlement expansion project is not new, but it is implemented just whenever Israel finds the conditions allowing it to do so. And it is very well known that the major Israeli project is the expansion from the borders of the Nile River in Egypt to the borders of the Euphrates River in Iraq. And Israel will never be deterred from implementing that with international statements, neither with international resolutions. Rather, what deters it is force and only force.
Saad Nimr, I'm not too sure how to characterize what has happened, because it's not anything new. And we know that the UN is being used as a political ploy, in a sense, or a tool, in order to show maybe that something maybe is being done. But really, facts on the ground speak for themselves, as we have seen throughout the years and decades. So putting the UN aside, even debating about it, I think would be futile. I don't know if you agree or not. In order to figure out a solution to stop, especially this current administration, from pursuing its expansion of settlements, which there were 9 that were announced. They may stop now, but they're still going to move forward with it. Are we looking at just Palestinians that have to create the conditions to stop them from expanding?
Well, in reality, it's quite obvious what happened in the United States, in the United Nations yesterday. It was coming out with a statement rather than a resolution to condemn Israel for its settlements. It was, on the other hand, I would say that Hamas is not only criticizing the United Nations, but it is, in a way, implicitly, they are also criticizing the Palestinian Authority. Because in the last few days, there was a kind of a marathonic talks between United States, Israel, Emirates, and the Palestinian Authority, in order to deter the Emirates from getting to the United Nations Security Council resolution, which condemned Israel and asking Israel to stop all kind of settlements, in a resolution by the United Nations. And the Americans, they were, you know, threatening at the beginning to use the veto, and that will put them really in a very embarrassing kind of situation, especially that they are being criticizing also the Israeli administration for its settlements and the expansion of settlements and building new settlements.
Let me thank our guest, Yonah Rabai, their activist and political analyst from Beirut, and Saad Nimr. We do appreciate your comments from occupied Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Well, the removal of an Israeli diplomat from a summit of the African Union has triggered controversy. The union says it suspended Israel's observer status at the bloc last year, so no Israeli should have attended in the first place.
We have not invited any Israeli to this assembly. We have noted that somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall. This is a person who does not reside in Ethiopia, and we are conducting investigations to know how the individual got accredited. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have not invited any Israeli authorities. We are going to push this investigation to the fullest to know where the error was coming from.
A video circulating on social media shows security personnel confronting the Israeli diplomat. That's during the opening ceremony of the summit. Before the diplomat leaves the auditorium, Israel has claimed its envoy was an accredited observer and has slammed the South African Algeria for the expulsion of the envoy. The regime attained observer status at the bloc in 2021. South Africa and Algeria protested the decision at that time. They said it runs counter to the bloc's statements in support of Palestinians. Earlier, political analyst Zafar Bangash told us about Israeli efforts to, quote, penetrate Africa.
Well, you know, we need to keep in mind that Israel is a pariah state, and it needs to be, recognized. It wants recognition, so it has been blackmailing and bribing some of the African rulers, and I'm sure that there is something untoward and illegal going on between the chairman of the African Union and Israel, because he took that decision unilaterally. But for Israel, of course, you know, it wants to penetrate Africa. It wants to claim that it is being recognized by the rest of the world. And I'm glad that South Africa and Algeria took this principled stand and they pushed for Israel's expulsion. And I also like to pay tribute to the efforts of civil society groups in South Africa, in particular, Africa for Palestine and the Media Review Network, that had carried a vigorous campaign through the South African government to throw Israel out of that union and not grant them observer status.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
History of knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. The year 2022 was dubbed by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of knowledge. As per the UNESCO motto of the year 2022, more serious attention has been paid to sciences like physics, chemistry, math, geology, biology, statistics, and genetics. Planning and execution of events related to basic sciences, promotion of programs to familiarize various nations with their notables in basic sciences, and acquaintance with the global capacities of this domain were among the programs of last year. In this new series, we are going to make you familiar with the past record of basic sciences in Iran and the innumerable services that Iranians have rendered to mankind through centuries. Basic sciences play an important role in execution of developmental programs. For instance, they provide us with necessary tools to face vital challenges, such as global access to food, energy, hygiene, and communication technologies. Basic sciences are the fundamentals of technological progresses. Moreover, training of specialists and development of life conditions require the growth and development of basic sciences. History of production of sciences in Iran dates back to very old times. Knowledge was venerated and respected so much so that poets would versify poems on the issue. The globally renowned poet Abolghasem Ferdowsi was one of such poets. Among other poets who have glorified knowledge, mention can be made of Rudaki, Samarqandi, Nasir Khosrow, Saadi, and so on. Nasir Khosrow says in a poem that if you achieve knowledge, you will dominate over the sky. Islam has put a special emphasis on acquisition of sciences, and different sciences are highly recommended, particularly those which are more useful for mankind. In view of this, scholars, scientists, and researchers are highly respected. Although Iran, due to its unique geopolitical situation, diverse climates and endless resources, has been subjected to cruel assaults of different invaders, it has attracted the beauties of invading cultures and highly impacted them. Therefore, today, one can find countless customs, vocabulary, and inventions among many nations which have their roots in Iran's rich culture. Iran used to be known as the cradle of sciences. For example, Muhammad ibn Zakaria Khwarazmi devised algorithm which revolutionized the science of algebra. Hence, he founded the basis for Indian and Iranian arithmetic system. This caused Europeans to change their numerical system from Latin into Indian. Al-Khwarizmi's inventions had a fundamental impact on advancement of math in Western countries. Medicine has had a bright record in Iran, and many books have been written in this field. Iran has played a significant role in expansion of sciences in ancient Greece and has also been influential in the Indian medicine. Jondishapur University in Ahvaz was a noted academic center in old Iran, and many students would come to it to study sciences, particularly medical sciences, as there was a hospital adjacent to the university, which has been claimed to be the first hospital in the modern meaning of the word. This hospital enjoyed separate wards for different patients and various medical services. Muhammad Zakaria Razi, The renowned Iranian physician, chemist, and philosopher was the first person to use experimental medicines to cure diseases. He discovered alcohol, sulfuric acid, chloric acid, and citric acid. He attained many achievements in medicine so that George Sartain has called him the greatest physician of Islam and Middle Ages. Apparently, Ibn Sina or Avicenna authored his Al-Qanun book through inspiration of Razi's Al-Hawi. Nearly 1,000 years ago, Abu Rayhan Biruni, another globally noted Iranian genius, wrote an encyclopedia on astronomy wherein he has discussed the rotation of the Earth around the Sun. A long time before the Danish Tycho Brahe, he drew the first map of the sky using the pictures and figures of animals to describe heavenly constellations and bodies. In 10th century AD, the prominent Iranian astronomer and mathematician Abdurrahman Sufi studied the stars and for the first time registered the galaxy without the help of a telescope. He discovered the nebula Chained Woman on Andromeda Galaxy. Thus, he corrected the views of Ptolemy. Jaber ibn Hayyan was an Iranian chemist and philosopher who is known as the father of chemistry. His discoveries have been gathered in an encyclopedia. This genius devised many methods and invented many tools which are used to date by chemists. Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in the West, was another great Iranian scientist who is famous for his writings on optics and experiments on lens, mirror, and light. He's known as the father of light physics. To name a few other Iranian scientists, mention can be made of the astronomer and mathematician Abu Abbas Fazl Hatam Nehrizi, Banu Musa brothers, who were specialists in math, astronomy, and mechanics. We can also name Abu Zayd Ahmad ibn Balkhi, geographer and mathematician, Abu al-Wafa Buzjani, mathematician and astronomer, Qiyasuddin Jamshid Kashani, mathematician and astronomer, and Omar Khayyam, astronomer, mathematician and poet. Well, on that note, we have come to the end of this episode. We hope that you have enjoyed this program. Till next episode, goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today, in our studio, we have with us a special guest, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and a research scholar over here in the Hawza Almi of Qom. And we have been discussing a series of, we went through a series of episodes with Professor Naqvi where we discussed the levels of Tarbiyah and most important topics of Tarbiyah Islamic upbringing with him. And today we are continuing some important topic with him. Professor, we had a very interesting question. When a three-year-old was making some mistake and a mother was concerned about the future of the child, she was wondering if the child could repeat the mistake and not accept his mistakes in future. Well, we do have so many people around today who are even adults. They don't accept their mistakes, even if they are wrong at some place where they should accept their mistakes. What do you think? What does go wrong in the upbringing that leads to this thing that they do not accept the mistakes as they grow up?
Number one, they should be, when they observe their parents, they don't learn this from their parents. As I said, if we were, as parents, if we were giving them a good example of accepting each other's mistakes, even if we've not made a mistake, and as I mentioned before, if my wife feels offended, and it's not because of any wrong things that I've done, she feels offended by some action or my behavior, but it's not a wrong behavior, even then if I accept that, okay, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, let's forget it, then that is a way of showing my children that you can accept mistakes even if you have not committed them. I mean, just to appease a person whom you love, or you can accept your mistakes even if they are not apparently your mistakes. So that's one thing, that we don't find good examples in our lives, especially from our parents, from our elderly people. All the time we're seeing each other blaming each other. This is one situation. Another situation is that maybe as a child, our parents, especially our mothers, were always defensive and trying to justify what we've done. So that
exactly. That's what most mothers do.
So one thing is that the mother scolds you tells you off in front of others. That's something not good, especially for something which is very, very not a big mistake at all. And secondly, mothers start justifying the mistakes that we have made. For example...
So there are two factors basically behind the fact. Okay.
So that sometimes you find mothers scolding, instead of telling them the child to take care of the door which is in front of him or her when he's going to the other room, instead of taking care and hitting the door.
Now if he strikes the door.
Instead of opening it properly, the door slams upon him and he's hurt about that by that. So the mother would start hitting the door, that the door was wrong in doing so, whereas the child carried out the mistake. Now, again, you're not supposed to scold him, or you're not supposed to tell him that it was not a good thing you did. You should have opened the door properly, for example. So teach, at least we need to teach them what the right thing is. Yeah. That is important. But how we do it is very important. And certainly it's not good to always, reprimand them and to tell them off that, oh, you're making mistakes. No, tell them what the right thing is to do. Tell them what is the right thing to do and how it should be done properly. Show them, look, this is how you should open a door, instead of, bashing into it.
Kicking the door and bashing the door itself.
Yes.
All right. So it's actually, if your child is hurt by a door, for example, you don't have to bash the door. You have to actually teach your child how to take care when he's going in and out of the room rather than bashing the door, because this way he's not going to accept mistakes. Here he thinks door was wrong and in future he thinks others were wrong. Well, we're going to discuss more after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab. I'm with Professor Naqavi, and we were talking about the adults who don't accept their mistakes as they grow up, or the teens as they are in the late teens and they don't accept their mistakes. Where does upbringing go wrong? Professor Naqavi, the first thing you said is that mothers, either they have scolded a lot, or parents, both the parents, the father, the mother, or both of them have scolded the child so much for a mistake that he's not going to accept it any time in the future. Or the second thing, whenever your child was doing wrong, rather than teaching him, you were actually bashing this and that, even the non-living things, like we gave the example of a door. Well, that was about this question. Now we have another question. This is a lady who is 67 years old, and she wonders about her granddaughters who take less care of hijab, or who are actually more concerned about their clothes and their outlooks, because she says, what I have learned throughout my age is that if time goes back and I had to rectify something, is not to spend so much money on how we look like, because others don't give a damn. But my granddaughters are actually doing the same thing, and even modesty is getting diminished day by day. So how do we help them?
So actually, you can't go back in time and change your behavior. So that's the issue. Basically, that is the reason why all this is happening, that the example they have seen all their lives was their mothers giving so much attention to their makeup and to their apparent features and their clothes and how they dress up, how they make up, how they even show off their ornaments and jewelry and all that. So it becomes a vicious cycle. Some sort of, all the time we're looking as what others feel, how others feel about us, and how others should be. We want to show off in front of them. So our children would certainly learn the same thing. Now, of course, there comes a certain age in adolescence, especially girls. They want to, and boys even, they want to show off what they are.
They're more concerned about what others think of me.
Yes, and their own features are important. They really get
obsessed
with their own features. And they feel. They give excessive time to how they look, and how others would look up to them. So this is a situation which has to be tackled in a very sensitive manner. This form of expression of one's inner energy should be given other channels. I mean, the expression should not be just with one's own features or one's own expressions or clothing or apparently how we look. It can be transferred and channelized into other positive, constructive activities where we allow our children to express their innovation and the creativity,
yeah,
and how they can change things for the better, take care of others. So
right.
This is what they should be learning at school. They should be learning at home. For example, I may have mentioned this. There's a school principal that I know of. When I went to his home, there was a cycle. Bicycle, which was a motorcycle, a bicycle, a smaller child was opening, tearing it down and building it up, or the motorcycle, or whatever, different gadgets. They were there in the house, in the garage, where the children were free to do whatever they liked.
So
they were constructing and
using that ability, basically.
So
yeah.
this feeling of being able to express oneself can we channelize into constructive things?
We'll discuss more after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, you were saying that constructive ideas should be put into, actually, we should be working upon the constructive part of our children before it becomes destructive.
One of the basic senses, or the one of the dimensions of human nature is aesthetics, beauty. Everyone is concerned with this. It's something which is intrinsic in our human nature. As we like knowledge, we are obsessed with knowledge. We want to acquire knowledge. In the same way, we like things which are beautiful.
Yeah.
So we are looking for beauty everywhere. So the sense of aesthetics is there in all human beings. And this sense has to be somehow coordinated with the sense of beauty which we have in the creations of Allah Almighty. This feeling of this obsession with beauty somehow should be synchronized with the beauty of the creation of the universe.
Yeah.
And to be able to replicate that in our lives. So example, just give me an example. When one paints something, makes a painting, or makes, for example, a drawing of something which is natural.
All right.
So there's a connection here being created between the natural beauty which is out there,
yeah,
and the beauty which is within us, to be able to create that thing which replicates that natural beauty.
All right. That's so beautiful.
So this is how we can somehow make our children interact with nature, the true beauty of the nature, which is a manifestation of God's power and will. So that is important, how we channelize that feeling of, you know, expressing yourself and showing yourself off. It can be made to be manifested in different activities which are pastimes or hobbies, which should become a part of our daily lives. And so today, unfortunately, taking care of these
materialistic apparent features.
I mean, if you're not giving them this opportunity, then they're going to be engaged with
them. Use the same passion somewhere else. Because if we contemplate about Surah Adiyat, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that in the contemplation of the surah, that He has kept some passion within us, but He wants us to use that passion to move towards Him. But we are moving, actually running, like the fast running horses who are running in their races towards the dunya, towards the other things. And then He says, "Innal insana li rabbihi lakanud." Indeed, the humankind is so ungrateful towards their God, because the passion that was supposed to take us towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is actually taking us away, far away from Him, because we have used the same passion against Him, not towards Him. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Human rights group Al-Mizan has found that the Zionist regime's drones or unmanned aerial vehicles have killed at least 2,146 Palestinians and damaged 3,332 homes from 2000 to 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Atallah al-Attar, 35, gets anxious in the evenings. He lives on his family's farm in the town of Beit Lahia, in northern Gaza Strip, close to the boundary with the occupied Palestinian territories. Evenings are when the Zionist regime's drones most often fly overhead. On this particular January afternoon, he softly explained why he has an acute fear of drones. He said, "The incident is very painful. In May 2019, he was working as a security guard at a wedding venue in Beit Lahia. He was taking a break with a friend, Khaled Abu Ghaligh, 24, when they saw and heard the Zionist regime drones flying overhead, which was not unusual. Al-Attar thought the drones were just surveilling the area, but then the men felt the explosion. Al-Attar said, the explosion made a huge sound, and the shrapnel from the missile flew at us. Shrapnel hit Al-Attar in the eye and the legs. The pain was excruciating, but he mostly recalls his friends' cries for help. One moment, Al-Attar remembers. Abu Alir was eating a meal and drinking coffee in nearby shipping container. The next, debris and shrapnel had hit Abu Ghaligh in the head. And by the time an ambulance arrived, he was unconscious. It was while Al-Attar was receiving treatment for his wounds at the hospital that he learned of Abu Ghaligh's death. A subsequent Human Rights Watch report stated that the Zionist regime drone had bombed a metal shipping container outside a businessman's villa and found that none of the individuals killed or injured by the Zionist strike had any ties to armed Palestinian groups. Doctors amputated Al-Attar's foot, and he now walks with crutches. He has 4 children, but he is currently unable to work, neither as a security guard nor on his family's farm, harvesting strawberries and grain. He said, Israeli regime drones are not only for reconnaissance and killing, they also sabotage water farms by spraying pesticides. I have seen this before, and the drones give me constant anxiety. They killed my friend, and they almost killed me. the Zionist regime began using drones in the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians in 2004, according to Al Mizan. And nearly a decade later, they have grown to be the most lethal weapons, particularly in assassinations and attacks on crowds. Drones have much longer flying times, states Human Rights Watch, and some are able to operate continuously for more than 24 hours. Military researcher Yusuf al-Sharghawi, a retired Palestinian Authority major general, said that the Zionist regime's most used drones in Gaza are the quadcopter and the Hermes 450, the latter of which conducts nighttime surveillance with its infrared sensors and can carry missiles. He said, drones take videos, track and assassinate. They also direct bomber aircrafts. Israel is looking to develop these drones to have the most powerful drones in the West Asia region. But in Gaza, they are the most lethal weapons and violate international humanitarian law. Palestinian factions have downed drones in Gaza most recently on January 27th, and with Hamas saying that important sensitive information was obtained. The Israeli regime's war on Gaza during the summer of 2014 brutally demonstrated the destructive reach of drones. While Defense for Children International Palestine found evidence suggesting that Israeli regime forces directly targeted children that summer, with drones killing at least 164 children, other attacks carried out by the Zionist regime throughout Gaza targeted many more civilians. Anwar al-Zanin, 43, an employee of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, had reported that an Israeli regime strike had damaged a water line near his home in northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, and the municipality sent workers to repair it. Sofyan Abu Harbid, 49, and Majdi Shabat, 50, were repairing the water line when an Israeli regime drone dropped yet another missile nearby. All three men were injured by the strike and taken to the hospital. Abu Harbid's leg was fractured, and Shabbat sustained injuries to his back, arms, and hands. Azanin was more seriously wounded and died later. Now, Abu Harbid refuses to work while Israeli regime drones are in the sky, as the attack produced a lasting psychological trauma. "The event is still terrifying me," he said, adding, "At first, the presence of drones just meant it was monitoring our movements, but now the army intends to hurt and kill us from all directions, sea, land, and air. The Israeli army can kill us without justification." Hala Abu Hajar, 38, lives in the village of Johr, east of Gaza City. She is a widow and the mother of four children. Drones are active in the area, she explains. Like Al-Attar, who was injured by the drone strike in Beit Lahia, Abu Hajar also notes that the drones come out most often in the evenings. They are so high-pitched and loud and deafening vibration that it feels like they are another occupant in her home. During the 2014 war, she was walking with her children when she saw an Israeli regime drone drop missiles on a car and a motorcycle. She's now more afraid of drones than warplanes, she said. Sometimes when my children are playing near the house and they hear the sound of drones, they run back into the house. They are afraid the drones are going to bomb them. She believes their fear is justified, and she's also afraid. Evenings at home, should be peaceful, she said, but the drones make this impossible. There is barely a moment when she is not thinking of the drones and what they are capable of. The attacks feel unpredictable, even though their buzzing sound is unmistakable. She said, whenever I hear the drones, I feel danger nearby. Tension, headaches, anxiety, and sometimes I can't sleep. According to Mehr News Agency, the Zionist regime withdrew its troops from Gaza in 2005. 2 years later, though, the regime imposed a crippling blockade on the Palestinian territory after the Islamic resistance movement Hamas rose to power there. Ever since, the regime of Tel Aviv has waged three wholesale wars on the territory. Observers say the combination of the siege and military assaults is meant to render what is already the world's largest open-air prison even more uninhabitable. Over the past months, the fabricated regime of Israel has also ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the occupied territories. As a result of these attacks, dozens of Palestinians have lost their lives and many others have been arrested. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the West Bank and East Al-Quds last year. In January 2023 alone, well over 30 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed. The United Nations marked 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.